Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the show. This is the classic replay midweek edition of Unbelievable, where we bring out a classic from our archive. There are so many good shows from the past that I think do actually, you know, have weathered well the ravages of time. It's always fun to bring them out and see what we make of them. Some 10 years on, some of these shows. This is actually October 2012. That today's show was first broadcast. Marcus Brigstocke, a well-known comedian on UK radio and TV, joined me. Now, Marcus is an atheist, and the previous year he'd written a book called God Collar about his problems with religion, but also why he wants to believe in God. He chatted with David Robertson, who at the time ran SOLAS, the Centre for Public Christianity, and they talked about UK comedy's atheist leanings, Marcus's criticisms of both religion and new atheism, the problem of evil, the Old Testament, and much more besides. Really interesting, wide-ranging, and quite fun show today. Just a reminder, though, that you can find more from Premier Unbelievable Faith Explored, our new umbrella ministry, bringing you all kinds of reasons to share your faith, to understand, defend and share it with confidence, and helping skeptics to explore the claims of faith as well. If you want to see more, go to premierunbelievable.com. The links are with today's show. But for now, here's the conversation between Marcus and David. Welcome along, and so pleased to have joining us on the phone today for today's programme, Marcus Brigstocke. He's a popular comedian on TV and radio. He's an atheist, and last year his book God Collar, while it takes a fairly dim view of much organised religion, still talked about a desire to believe in God. Well, Marcus is going to be joining us for today's programme as we both look at the kind of perspective that many contemporary comedians have on Christianity, faith, religion, but also about his own journey and where he stands in regard to his views on religion. David Robertson joins us, an ever popular guest on this programme, and he's, as you will have heard last week in his discussion with Peter D. Williams, Minister of St. Peter's Free Church in Dundee, Director of SOLAS, the Centre for Public Christianity up there in Scotland. That's who we've got on the programme joining us today. And we'll start off with Marcus, who it's great to have you joining us, Marcus. Thanks for making yourself available.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking.
It's great to have you. I wanted to get you on last year around the time of God Collar being released. It didn't work out in the end, but glad to you've made your time available now. Marcus, probably best to start off just giving us a little bit of background to yourself, both as a comedian and in terms of where you're put yourself on the faith spectrum. So how did comedy begin, first of all?
Well, comedy sort of began out of necessity, really, in that I became an adult and quite quickly realised that I wasn't really any good at anything very much. What really happened, actually, was that I wanted to be an actor, and I tried to get a place at drama school, and failed in the first round of auditions, having sort of very much hoped and actually assumed somewhat that I would, because I'd been in plays and all the rest of it at school, and everyone had always said, oh, you're a good actor. Anyway, I failed to get in, and then I went and had lunch with a very good friend of mine, and he said, well, to be honest, mate, you know, you might be a reasonably good actor, but you're funny. You should do comedy. And I said, well, yeah, that's all very good, but firstly, it's terrifying, and secondly, how do you do it? And he phoned me the next day, and he said, I've booked you a gig. And he just, know, he had just booked me an open spot, and I went and I did 5 minutes, and he came with me, and he watched, and the first sort of 3.5 minutes were absolutely terrible as I pulled various badly thought through props out of my clothing, and then sort of put the props down and started talking, and the last minute and a half was enough for me to think, if I can do this for the rest of my life, then I will be very happy with that. And that's exactly what happened, really.
You do hear...
And I'm still doing it.
Absolutely. I mean, you often hear stories of comedians' first wrenchingly bad stand-up show or something. It sounds like you had a show of two halves in some way. But
very much so. Very much so. It was around the time that Prince had changed his name from Prince to a symbol.
Yes.
And I think what I did is I created... sort of symbols that might represent various political and celebrity figures and drew them and showed them to the audience like sort of really bad show and tell. So, it makes me shudder.
Take us, though, to where have you stood on the faith spectrum? Was there any point in your life that you were ever influenced towards believing in God, or is that something you've never found yourself capable of doing?
Well, I sort of have. I mean, I talk about this a bit in the book, in that I was given faith sort of as a kid in the way that a great many people are, in that it's assumed, well, you know, we're sort of nominally Christian, so our children will sort of nominally be Christian. And I wasn't appalled by anything, nor particularly lit up by it. I remember mostly being quite bored by sort of the lack of passion and all the rest of it in the way that we were taught religion, and, you know, and had to sing hymns every morning and stuff, which I found very slow. There's a special sort of sound when 300 children sing a hymn that they don't really understand and don't really care about, and it's sort of, I likened it to a helium balloon the day after a birthday party that sort of tries to float up and it just can't quite.
It can't quite.
I thought as an image, you know, the idea of this hymn trying to penetrate the ceiling of the school and make it all the way up to where at that time we absolutely imagined God was, which was above. And it sort of gently bounced off the ceiling and then sunk back down. So that, you know, I sort of had that as a kid. And then I lost interest, but not in any sort of thoughtful way. Right. And then I ran into some bother in my late teens. I had problems with addiction and stuff. And part of the recovery from that was to believe in a power greater than yourself, which we called God. And it was very useful, but it wasn't a God that I think anybody would identify with. It was just a useful sort of idea for me.
Well,
then it just
drifted
away from that. Sorry, I'm giving a full pot of history, but anyway, I drifted away from that, and then became, as I got more and more into comedy and started reading more, became very determinedly atheist and very. You know, very much on the Hitchens-Dawkins bandwagon. And then what happened was the friend that I just talked about, the one who had booked my first gig for me, my very dear friend James, died. And I found myself suddenly in a very cold and rather lonely sort of place, explaining to his children that, you know, one of whom is my godson, if you want to, then you can talk to Daddy and he can hear you. And, you know, saying the things to them that I actually was desperate for somebody to say to me, because I missed my friend, I still do. And I wanted him to be somewhere, and I wanted some structure in my life that might make sense of that. And it would be dishonest to say that I turned to God or I had a sort of religious experience, but I certainly... I found my atheism challenged, and I found the conversations I had with some of my friends who had seemed so confident and seemed to have so many of the answers, I suddenly found them terribly lacking and actually rather cold and mean-spirited about the things that I was saying to them. Mm. I didn't think it was enough for my friend just to live on in my imagination. So that was how I began to really explore separating out faith, as I see it, the act of faith, and that I think has tremendous value from religion, which has been and continues to be necessarily a political, or at least a politicized thing to engage
right.
with.
I mean, it's a very honest book, and honest both about obviously your where you differ from religious views, but also where you differ from staunchly atheist views. You know, you're pretty honest about the fact your atheism is a bit more fragile than say, you know, a Richard Dawkins kind of approach. So fascinating stuff. And as I mentioned on the show today, David Robertson in studio with me to interact on this. David, you've had a chance to read Marcus's book. What was your overall impressions as you engaged with his views on religion and his own sort of struggle to some extent with atheism?
Well, Marcus, thank you so much for the book, because I must admit I began to read it the same way that I began to read The God Delusion, Richard Dawkins, with a sense of dread. And as usual, I mean, I expected it to be funny, and thankfully it was, which is quite good for you as a comedian to hear that anyway.
Yeah, that's important.
It did. You know, I was laughing as I was reading it on the train and reading it on my Kindle, actually. But there were so many things that you said that were kind of spooky because they mirrored my own experience. I mean, I think there were things you said in there that were wrong, and we would disagree about them. And but I was just struck. I mean, I was struck even in you talking just now. You said about wanting to be an actor and ending up a comedian. Well, I wanted to be a politician and ended up a preacher.
You see, I would say immediately there's very little difference.
Yeah,
you probably have far more influence.
Well, I was told that as well. But also, your thing with school, I find that intriguing, because I think religion in school reminds me of an analogy that someone said. It's like getting the flu jab. In the flu jab, you get given a wee dose of flu so that you'll be inoculated against the real thing. And yes. I think that happens with religion in school. I mean, I did find your book just incredibly fascinating. I mean, I was wanting to ask you about comedy and the Christian faith anyway, but can I ask you, is it okay, Justin, if I ask
please,
a question?
Please go ahead.
Maybe I will ask you about that before we come on to some of the more personal stuff. I mean, I have this theory, I don't know if you think this is right or not, that stand-up comedians are kind of like the preachers stroke prophets of our age, where, you know, I've been to hear Reginald D. Hunter, my wife went to hear Bill Bailey, Richard Herring, you know, people like that. And very, very popular. Stand-up comedy is incredibly popular. It's not just making jokes, it's social comment. It does tend to be largely one way. I mean, I know that some of you like a heckler or every now and then to go, but it does tend to be kind of almost preaching what the congregation want to hear. I've sometimes thought that. But what struck me and really surprised me was how anti-religious some of the shows I've been to are. And that most of the audience, as you acknowledge in the book, most of the audience lap that up. But I mean, with the exception of Frank Skinner, I mean, are there any comedians who are Christians, or you know?
Yes, there are. There are very, very few who make any reference to it on stage, if any. I mean, this is quite different in the States.
Yeah.
Although, you know, the majority of comedians in the States who have any significant profile would probably identify as agnostic or atheist you know, uninterested in religion. Yes, there are. In fact, Tim Vine, who's Jeremy Vine, who's a very brilliant joke slinger.
He's a punster, isn't he?
Yeah. But there's a great moment, actually, at the end of his DVD that I just adored, partly because it had made me so nervous. I love Tim. I think he's brilliant. And at the end of his DVD, he starts to tell the footprints story.
Yeah.
You know, God is a man with God at the end of his life, looking back over the his life, and they see it as footprints in the sand. And at the hardest times in his life, there's only one set of footprints. And he says, God, why is it at the hardest times you've abandoned me? And God says, no, it was at those times that I carried you. And Tim starts to tell this story, and I was watching it thinking, don't do it, Tim. Don't, because you're so funny. You're so funny. And this is a good story, and it's very sweet, but why tell it?
Right.
Why tell it? And Tim says this. He says, a man is at the end of his life, and he's talking to God, and he's looking back at over his life, and he sees it as a series of footprints in the sand, two sets of footprints. But at the hardest times in his life, there's only one set of prints, and he says to God, why is it that at those times in my life, God, you seem to have abandoned me? God smiles and says, no, my child, you're mistaken. It was at those times I thought it would be more fun if we hopped. And I just thought it was the most beautiful joke. To take that story, which is a really good one anyway,
yeah,
and to invest it with that, to, if that's the God that Tim has in his life, that's filled with that capacity for joy and humor, and the idea of God saying, no, do you know how you get through hard things is not always, you know, by clinging emotionally to someone, but by hopping and being silly and joyful. And I just, that absolutely lit me up. But no, there are very few religious comedians.
I mean, I can think only perhaps of, I know Milton Jones has a faith.
Yes, he does. Yeah.
And but as you say, it's not something comedians tend to wear on their sleeve, is it, Mark? Because I mean,
no.
I read actually last year Frank Skinner's biography from a few years ago now, autobiography, and he had this really interesting little anecdote of being on a plane back from Germany with Eddie Izzard, and he at this point Eddie Izzard was just sort of starting his sort of more transvestite type act, and Frank was like, oh, what could I do that could shock my audience a bit, you know? And he said, what about this, Eddie? I could start talking about the fact I believe in God. And Eddie was like,
yeah,
no, they're not ready for that. That's just too far.
True.
You know, it's sort of like, that's the ultimate controversial kind of thing to do these days. I mean, it's kind of interesting, though, isn't it? I almost feel a bit like Marcus. It's not that countercultural anymore for a comedian to stand up and sort of make fun of religion. It's kind of...
No, it's not.
It's not.
And
it?
Actually, I didn't write God Collar as a show, which it was first, as a sort of, oh, this will be a handy piece of marketing. It was a thing that happened. And I found myself with all of these questions. And a friend of mine said, well, you should do a show where you question things rather than say that you have all the answers. That's much more interesting. And so I did that, and the result of God Collar, the show and the book, actually seems to have been that it's upset secularists much more than it's upset anybody religious. The secularists have, in great numbers, said to me, well, what's going on? I mean, are you one of us or are you not? Which I found fascinating, because why on earth would that matter?
Yeah.
So there's that. But I think, you know, the church enjoys privilege. It enjoys a huge amount of privilege, even in the increasingly secular European countries and in the UK. It enjoys privilege. So the things that enjoy privilege are pretty hard to represent, to represent positively as a comedian. I mean, we tend to set about knocking things down, although I wouldn't want people to think that that's just the aim, just to be cynical. And I think it's very difficult for something as well established as the church to find someone who's able to find a lot of humour in it. What my aim was, having found Richard Dawkins a singularly sort of humourless and unsympathetic man, was to be mocking of that and of that position, which I managed to do in sort of, I don't know whether it was equal measure, because that wasn't the aim, but just to be honest about how I felt about it, you know. But I think it would be very difficult for somebody to, somebody who is religious, to write a lot of comedy about it, partly because, you know, if you have a sense of faith, if you have a great sense of devotion to God, I would imagine that separating that out into the ability to be really funny about it would be very difficult.
Yeah,
I don't tend to talk about things I love on stage as much as I do things that frustrate me and I feel like need fixing.
Yeah, and I mean, I appreciate that. I think the thing that intrigues me, though, is, for example, I listen to The Now Show. And, I mean, it's very easy. It's an easy target to lampoon George Bush-type rednecks. you know, and it's, and it is funny, and the Now Show sometimes does it really, really well, but it does seem to me almost incredibly one-sided. I mean, when I went to hear Reginald D. Hunter, he had an Australian comedian as his warm-up act, and actually the Australian comedian, I mean, he was crude and lewd and, you know, all the rest of it, but he had some hilarious stuff about Richard Dawkins and so on. I thought, well, that balanced it, you know. And I thought your book did.
You say it's one-sided, and, you know, in terms of what happens on the show, well, yes, it is, but you were talking about President Bush.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, that's the other side. He was president for two terms.
Yeah, I know.
And I mean, his constituency were represented. And I mean, I keep my fingers crossed for America that Mitt Romney gets nowhere near that presidency. And the type of Christianity that the Tea Party would claim they represent is, to my mind at least, is so destructive. And also, I would argue, not that I have the right perhaps, but I would argue is a very long way from anything that Jesus was interested in and seems to have represented from my understanding of it.
I'd be inclined to agree with you, although, I mean, what I also think is that the type in this country, we're not really faced with a whole bunch of George Bush-type rednecks.
No, we're not.
I think, you know, it's a bit of a red herring when people raise that and, you know, watch out the tartan Taliban and all that kind of stuff coming from Scotland. But I do think, and I suspect you've had this reaction, if you want to see sparks fly, just go on to something like the Dawkins website or one of the secular websites and question the one true faith of secularism. And, I mean, you're condemned to secular hell, whatever that is.
Yes, you know. Absolutely. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, that's why I sort of parted company with that. I mean, I did, in my criticism of Dawkins, I missed out in the book something that's very simple that somebody pointed out to me afterwards. A great deal of the footage that you see or hear of Richard Dawkins, he is answering the same question again. The same question that he's been asked over and over and over again by, you know, creationists who haven't done who haven't read the other book.
Yeah.
I mean, read the Bible and draw your conclusions from that. If you haven't read On the Origin of Species or a similar work, if you haven't read and understood that, you are not qualified to take part in a discussion about creation versus evolution. You are not. And for Dawkins, I do get why he loses his temper where that's concerned with people who say, well, meh, whatever it may be. And then he's very brusque and very rude and all the rest of it. Because if you haven't read it or something similar, then why are you engaging in a scientific debate? You could argue, I've read the Bible and that tells me everything that I need to know. In which case, if it were me having that discussion, I would say, well, all right then, you have no need to hear anything that I have to say, because
that's end of discussion. But I think Dawkins does that too.
Discussion.
But Dawkins does that too. I mean, it's not that he's frustrated at arguing with ignoramuses. In fact, he prefers to argue with ignoramuses. He gets frustrated when people seem to be suggesting there is no debate. And I'm not talking about creation evolution. I mean, I'm really talking about God. I mean, I've got so many quotes. I mean, my wife hates this. I underline or highlight things, and there are some books that there are just so many multicolored, and yours is now one of them. I've got actually 20 pages of quotes from your book that I loved, and for me as a preacher, you're an absolute godsend. You're great material. But I love this one. I thought this was great. This isn't me. I'm interested in God to an almost obsessional extent, given how unlikely I think his existence. I've never stalked anyone before, but if God had bins, I'd definitely rifle through them. I tell you, I mean, I don't know where Justin wants to go with all this, but what interests me, for me, the question is, you know, you have a desire to believe in God. What stops you believing?
Well, a number of things. My inability to accept a couple of important things, like, for example, ours is not to understand the mind of God, would seem, I don't know if that's a into discussions mm-hmm. with people. Ours is not to understand the mind of God. You know, there are certain things where I think I've been encouraged to sort of switch off and say, well, you know, it's like God moves in mysterious ways. Well, I don't want anybody sneaking about. And his mysterious ways are not for me. So I'm not able to switch off, to disconnect from the politics of religion. So there is that. That's not a reason not to believe in God, but it's certainly a massive obstacle.
Yeah.
And then I suppose it's the God that was presented to me as a child and the God that is most readily available and the one that I discuss in the book, which is the God of the Muslims, the Jews, and the Christians, the God of Abraham. There were too many of the stories that were presented to me when I was young, and, you know, even now as an adult, that I feel very sure I cannot be true because of other things that I've read that I find more compelling and convincing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when you say, well, we know that God did not create the universe and the earth and you and I, certainly in any of the ways described in any of the Abrahamic religious texts, well then, who is he then? What is he?
Yeah.
What is there? And, you know, the more those stories stack up and you find, oh, well, that also kind of happened and the bush didn't actually speak and burn and, you know, a person probably didn't walk on water, although I sort of separate out the Jesus things. I have different frustrations where that's concerned. But, I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm not a scientist, and that's really important. So I'm not looking at this in terms of evidence. You know, there isn't enough scientific evidence to support the idea of God. For me, it's much more sort of, I've read a fair bit, and it just doesn't stack up for me. And the desire to believe is not enough to, has not so far been enough to engage with it.
Yeah. Can I basically go with the first one, and then I think Justin's one that came in with something, but, you know, that first one about switching off your mind, you've got another quote there in God Caller: my brain is flawed, jumbled, logical and illogical all at once. My brain has looked at the facts as they are and said there probably is no God. This isn't foolishness. Ignoring information is foolishness. Research, thought, discussion and debate seem reasonable to me. Well, I mean, I wholeheartedly endorse that. I think that the solution to that situation, that if someone has said to you, just switch your mind off, then I question how Christian they are, and they certainly don't understand.
Yeah.
Because the point about faith is, faith in and of itself is not a good thing. You know, if you have faith that, you know, if I had faith that if I flew a plane into a tower building, I was going to end in heaven with 90-odd virgins or whatever it was, that's ludicrous. If I have faith that the man who's invited my daughter to come round and play with him is going to just give her ice cream, that's fine. You know, that's just stupid faith. I think the Christian position on faith would be that it would have to be reasonable and logical. You're not to switch your mind off. But the caveat to that is to recognize that our minds are limited. So there are things that we will not understand or grasp. And to have a sense of awe and wonder, it doesn't mean that you don't explore. I mean, the way I explain it is, when I first became a Christian, somewhat reluctantly, I was one of these awful Christians who knew everything. And I was like the kid in charge of the
paddling. Has that really changed, David? I don't know.
Yeah. I was like the kid in charge of the paddling pool. You know, I mean, I could say anything and knew everything. I think now I've been a Christian for 30 years, and without denying my faith, I would say I'm now like the kid who's at the edge of the ocean, dipping my toe in the water and saying, wow, there is so much more to learn. So I think real Christianity should stimulate reason and logic. And if you look at the early Christian apologists, they all called themselves that because they argued that Christianity was reasonable. And that would be a big position that I would take.
We are going to just go to a quick break, guys. So let's tackle this area and talk about Marcus's other problems with God as we continue this discussion. Fascinating so far as we talk about comedy and Christianity. Marcus Brigstocke is, of course, a very popular comedian on TV and radio. He's an atheist, and last year his book God Collar still talked about a certain desire to believe in God. He doesn't see things quite the way that a Dawkins or a Hitchens might. At the same time, he's got big problems with authoritarian structures of religion, some of the stories in the Bible and the way they seem to represent God. Well, we'll get into that, I'm sure, in the rest of today's program. David Robertson of St. Peter's Free Church in Dundee, director of SOLAS, the Centre for Public Christianity, our studio guest today. So come back again for more on this interesting question of God, comedy and the Bible. Well, coming back to you, Marcus, do you feel that there just aren't any good arguments out there that you've come across for believing?
Yeah, and you know, it's sadly impossible to separate out the politics from religious belief. Through necessity of geography and environmental circumstances through the years, it's been necessary for religious organizations to develop a political view of the world. Jesus was a massively political figure. And so religion in all its forms is now bound up in a type of politics. It's very, very easy for somebody to take from the Bible evidence that to be left-wing, to share one's things and look after each other and the poor and the children and all those sorts of things is the right thing to do because it's in the Bible, just as it is easy for the right wing, who I would argue have exploited it much more ruthlessly and with much more effect, to argue that, well, homosexuals must be kept in their place, as must women and any number of other people. And I, you know, the politics of religion trouble me terribly. And, you know, Jesus, broadly speaking, seems to have been the sort of person I would get along with. You know, sort of a bearded, sandal-wearing socialist, really. he seems like quite a decent bloke. But his endorsement of his father and the invitation, you know, only through me shall you enter the kingdom of heaven. Well, I don't like his dad. There seems to me, other than hearing again and again, God is love, very little evidence that God is love. His kindness towards man has far too often been at the expense of another man. And I really struggle with that. Mm-hmm. And I struggle with understanding suffering. If we are God's children, if God created us in his image, I don't understand why. You know, I mean, individual suffering, that's one thing, but for entire countries, entire regions, just to suffer day after day after day, for people to see them die or their parents suffer in front of them. If God made us all, if he really did, where is he in that? Where generation after generation, I find that too difficult. And then that connects through with just a central problem that I have with Christ, despite my admiration for a great many of the ideas that he believed in, which is that the miracles are a bit rubbish. You know, he healed the sick. Well, great. Okay, very good. I like that one. Walked on water. You know, all right, that's a magic trick. Turned water into wine. That's handy at a party. What about getting round the world instead of just existing in that tiny little pocket of the world? What about the ability to travel? That would have been a useful miracle. Right. If Jesus was the Son of God and God really cared about his creation, why didn't Jesus go a bit further geographically?
Okay. Let's take a few of those, shall we? I mean, you've raised quite a few really interesting points there, Marcus, and maybe if we could sort of interact with them one at a time. Politics, the way it's all, you know, Christianity is in bed with either the right, sometimes the left, but mainly the right, says Marcus. Big problem for him there, David. Anything you'd like to say to that?
Yeah, well, I'm inclined to agree with Karl Marx that religion is the opiate of the people, in that religion is a very, very useful tool for rulers to use to help them rule. And I think that Christianity falls into that trap as well, at least as rulers use it. But I mean, I would say the same thing about money and about sex. It doesn't make me not believe in either of those. I think just it's a misuse. And I know that in a little way, that's a bit of a cop-out. I mean, I happen to believe that everything that everyone does is in some sense political, in that it affects the polis, the society that we live in.
I quite agree.
Yes. So, I mean, I think comedy is political. When people say, oh, I don't like my comedians being political, of course they're political. You know, everything in that sense is. Where I agree with you, I mean, I agree with you completely that when you get situations like in this country, we now have an established church and a secular society, that seems to me an anomaly and just somewhat absurd. And actually, it works really bad for the Christian church, because what happens is you have people in empty churches retaining a status and a position of power which suits them, but doesn't help us, doesn't help ordinary Christians, and doesn't help us communicate our message and so on. It does seem to be a position of unearned and undeserved privilege. So, I mean, I'm not going to critique you on that one. I accept that criticism.
Well, you know, you come from a tradition which has always been about the separation of church and state anyway. So in that sense, you don't quibble that much with...
Well, in a way we were, and in another way we weren't. I mean, we thought... people who argue about separation of church and state and think it's a wonderful thing, go to America. You know, I'm not necessarily so keen on that. I just think what I don't like is people who use Christianity in particular, but any religion, in order to gain political power or wealth for themselves. And I don't believe that of the, 635 members of Congress, that there's only one who's an atheist. I just don't believe that. But it's political suicide in the States to say you're an atheist. And I just think that's wrong. I mean, in the same way as in this country, I don't agree when Alistair Campbell says we don't do God. I think that's wrong. I think it's wrong when...
That was a very important lie, because he knew at that stage that Blair was increasingly passionate about his Catholicism. And you know, what was revealed afterwards in the Blair diaries about the extent to which he had secretly become a very passionate Catholic... was huge in deciding many of the things that upset me personally and a great many other people. You know.
But Marcus, I think where Christianity comes into politics is this. I mean, Adam Smith, who wrote The Wealth of Nations, which is basically the foundation document for modern Western capitalism, for good or for ill, but he said without Christianity, capitalism just wouldn't work. And in my view, I think any system without, to my mind, without God, but without at least a suitable ethical system, just doesn't work. And I think that where Christianity has been good in this country has, to some extent, putting brakes on people's immoral behavior. You know, free market capitalism as such, without Christianity, to me, is a nightmare. So I think I wouldn't want to exclude Christianity from the political process, but what I wouldn't want to do is politicians and wealthy people use Christianity as a means to protect and defend themselves.
No, I mean, that's a very interesting point, because obviously you need something cohesive. You know, capitalism is a juggernaut. It's massive and powerful, and so you need groups of people to come together, and Christianity would very readily offer answers to some of the challenges thrown up by the current capitalist model, and it's sort of ready to go and ready to challenge some of that, which is all well and good. I mean, you know, we all, as you rightly point out, you know, alcohol, sex, everything that we do is political, and I don't actually have a problem with somebody, you know, somebody religious letting their faith guide them in their political decisions, provided we know what that is. You know, with that you return to Blair and say, well, that was dishonest. It's more that there are politics in the Bible. There are political positions described in the Bible that it's immensely difficult for anybody who relies on any of the three major religious to move on from. They had to, when they were written, speak to an eternal truth. It was no good the people writing the Bible saying, which we think is about right for now, but this will want revisiting in a while. So you have to read the Bible either as a series of metaphors, useful and unuseful, or as fiction, or, you know, if you're nuts, as total fact.
Well, let's talk about the Bible. Yeah, I mean, this comes up a lot in God Collar in one form or another. And you've talked about the fact, okay, you like Jesus' politics, but not his dad. And the fact that obviously he, you know, talks about, I'm the way to the Father, no one comes to the Father except through me. But the Father that you see in the Old Testament, not always a very nice character in your view. David, I'd just be interested in your response to that. Well, I mean, I think a lot of people have this sort of problem, and indeed, you know, probably Marcus is closer to Dawkins on this one when Dawkins sort of has this long list of adjectives describing the God of the Old Testament as a pestilential megalomaniac, blah, 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 blah. Where do you start on this yourself?
I think it's a misunderstanding of the God of the Old Testament, and Marcus, you probably shoot me on this one. I'm not a kind of guy who's going to argue it's all metaphorical and so on. I think that there's much more depth to it than that. I mean, if I was asked to describe the God of the Old Testament, the opposite of what Dawkins says, I would take out of the Psalms and so on, when he says he's loving, he's merciful, he's all-powerful, he's creator and so on. There are things that happen in the Old Testament that seem to be directly contrary to that, and you can create another image. I think the danger is we end up creating a God in our own image, what we look for, what we want. To me, there are things about God of the Old Testament, and actually Dawkins does get this right. Jesus is, to my view, much more controversial with some of the things that he says, and much more challenging. But I don't buy into this God as divine chess player, manipulating people, torturing people, not responding, cruelly creating people in one way and then beating them up for being that way. All this kind of imagery that people have, and I would basically, the only thing I can do with that is deconstruct it by saying, one, that's not the God I believe in. I mean, when I think U2, when Bono, in his preaching way that he does sometimes, talked about the preacher on the TV screaming out for TV, he says, well, the God I believe in, mister, doesn't need cash.
Yes.
I would say the God I believe in isn't that God whom you are critiquing in your book. And I actually don't think that is the God of the Bible. I don't deny that there are enormous difficulties and problems, but I think that you are responding to a very kind of weird and wet woolly view of Christianity that you got dosed with as a child, and then combined that with niceness, and then combined it with a really horrible reading of the Old Testament. I mean, is that?
I think that's about right. I mean, I do have a very emotional response to this stuff. One of the things that was sort of came up was that my son, following a christening that we'd been to, had just been introduced to some stories from the Bible when he was six, and he said that was the moment when I told him, well, you know, that christening we've been to was a bit strange for Daddy because I don't believe in God. And Alfie, who was six and went to a secular school, said, you have to believe in God or he'll send another flood like he did to Noah. Now, that was fine, you know, and I was able to talk to him and say, no, that's not right. And, you know, but it made me think about the number of nursery schools that are called Noah's Ark. And one of the great toys that you'll find in the children's area of a great many modern churches is an ark for them to play with, because it's full of animals, and isn't that lovely? Well, what happened there? You know, fact, myth, or metaphor, what happened? God took Noah, his wife, and their children, and two each of the animals and six of some of the others, and put them on an ark. And then he murdered absolutely everybody and everything else. And I don't know if you've ever seen footage of what a place looks like after a flood where a great many people or animals have died. But it's a sort of fetid, corpse-strewn, smelly, rotten place. So fact, myth, or metaphor, what on earth was going on there? I mean, what... God killed everybody? Well, everybody else? I mean, really?
Yeah, you've got... I mean... I was watching Andrew Marr's History of the World, and he was talking about how in China there's flood stories, and in South America there's flood stories, and so on. But I mean, I'm avoiding the question, really. You're absolutely right. I've always found it intriguing that we sing jolly little happy songs about Mr. Noah built an ark, that people thought it's such a lark.
Yeah.
And, you know, Mr. Noah pleaded so, but into the ark they would not go. Down came the rain in torrents, splish, splash. All done to a clapping of hands. And you're going, you're talking about wiping out. You know, this is not a kid's story. This is not a cute, cuddly thing just because it involves animals and Walt Disney wasn't alive then. You know,
What is that? Call the nursery school Noah's Ark.
Yeah, exactly. Noah's Ark Nursery.
You're going, what? Yeah, what on earth happens to the parents?
Yeah, your parents are going to be wiped out, child. Well, you see, that's the kind of thought. I mean, I think you and I are very similar in this. That's the kind of thought I would have had as a child, thinking, wait a minute, what's going on here? I think a more adult perspective for me would be this. Go back. I think one of your colleagues on, is Andy, I've forgotten his second name. The shorter guy.
Andy Serkis?
I've forgotten his name, but it doesn't matter. He's hilarious. But every now and then he might come out with a statement like, you know what I would do? I would just nuke the whole lot or something.
Oh, yes. And
there's a frustration that sometimes we feel with humanity. And all I would say with the Noah's Ark story is, what if that was the least worst option? In other words, what if it was possible to make a new start? What if the Earth was so completely screwed up and humanity was not this kind of cute, cuddly humanity we think, but it's so completely messed up that it was going to destroy the planet? I mean, we talk about, well, we don't, but people talk about Gaia and planet getting its revenge and all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
Humanity could screw the planet up again, and maybe the best thing for the planet would be if we were wiped out. Well, what if that? If some of what was going on was that? But that God, in His mercy, said,
"You found my weakness. You've gone straight in my Achilles' heel."
Yeah,
because you know, having read my book, that I do think that humanity are working very fast to destroy the planet and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Yes, I quite agree. However, I would need a God who's going to get any of my attention.
I mean, yeah,
to be better at it than that, to sweep all the pieces off the board.
Yeah, but there's another. Yes, but it is. You see, that's the point. I mean, I'm playing the what if game. There's a lovely verse. Yeah. In fact, I got into trouble in the States once preaching because I used this verse out of Revelation 10 that God announces the time has come to destroy those who destroy the earth. And afterwards, I remember a man coming up to me and saying, "You a tree hugging communist?" And I said, "Well, I'm a communist, but I don't hug trees."
Yes.
And his argument was, "Listen, it's all going to burn, so just I don't care if I've got four cars and all that kind of stuff."
Yeah.
And I said, "Good." I said, "That's good theology. So I'm coming around to your house just now to burn it down. You won't mind because it's all going to burn anyway."
Yeah.
I mean, and you know,
well, the energy secretary in Congress read from Genesis before delivering his report.
Yeah.
And said he talked about the things that God promised man after the flood. Where God says, I'll never do this again. And that was the basis of his thing. So, it's all right. That, God said, we'll be fine.
No, that's outrageous. You know? I mean, he didn't say anything about plague or, you know, global warming or whatever. But, I mean, the interesting thing about that is, what actually if God did? I mean, he makes us stewards of the earth to care for it and holds us accountable for it. But the question for me is, what has God actually done? I mean, I remember knocking on a guy's door because we were going around. I was picking up his daughter, who's 10 years old, who was coming to a kid's club. And he came out, and I can't do this on Premier Radio. He swore at me. I could do it in your comedy show, but he swore at me. And I said, "Whoa, what's going on here?" And he said, "You're not coming anywhere near, you know, my children again." And I said, "Well, what have we done? We're friends." And just he says, "I didn't realize you were a minister." And he said, "I hate God." He said, "I don't believe in God and I hate him." To which the obvious response was, "Yeah, isn't it a bit stupid hating something you don't think exists?" And he's, you know, did you smart aleck? And I said, "Look, honestly, what's up with you?" And he said, "My wife died when she was 34. And Christians told me it's God's will." And I said, "Oh, whoa, wait a minute." I said, "We got to." And we spent about 6 weeks, once a week, just sitting talking through some of the issues. And for me, the question ultimately was not, is there cancer in the world? Because that's what his wife died of. Or did God kill his wife? Because I don't think that God did. But the question is, well, if there's no God, there's still cancer in the world. Everything's still screwed up. But if there was a God, has he done anything about it? And that for me is the key thing. And when I read your book, I find the same thing. I find a misunderstanding of the God of the Old Testament and of the New, though perfectly understandable how you misunderstand it, given where you're coming from. But I also find a longing for something. There's got to be something a whole lot more and a whole lot better than this, and better than religions yeah. present, and better than atheism presents. And I actually think there is. And your question about Jesus Christ is where it comes back. You say, I mean, I loved, sorry, let me just, the miracles you mentioned. You know, he walked on water. The interesting thing about that for me is the humanity of it, because the disciples were out in a boat and they're about to be wrecked in a storm. And it was so reassuring for them to see, but Jesus' power over nature. The water to wine, I know we make jokes about that being a party thing, but actually it was. And it was the best quality wine that he turned yeah. it into. And it wasn't to say, hey, look, I can do a magic trick. It was actually to help out at a wedding.
Yeah, I mean, going back you know. To I mean, that joke that Tim Vine told about God hopping down the beach.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, the water into wine thing is that God who is fun, who wants the party yes. to go on. And kind of, it's a shame that they've run out of wine. Here you go, guys. Here's some of the best quality wine.
And yes, it's and yet it's also serious because he's saying, I mean, Jesus did miracles, not as party tricks, but to prove to his disciples who he was.
Yes.
I think the other, when you go to the getting around the world bit, this is where a lot of Christians, inverted commas, get it really wrong. They think, well, God is kind of like my divine slot machine in the sky. And hey, I want a Mercedes-Benz. Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? You know,
yes.
that's fine. And I think you'll find a lot of the Christianity that you despise are people who are using God in that way. And
yeah.
actually, I find myself with a God who laughs, but also a God who is distraught at the destructiveness that we've wreaked on his world. And I remember Freddie Mercury, who wasn't exactly the most noted Christian, was he? At Live Aid, the first Live Aid, standing up and singing with his guitar and almost a cappella. If there's a God up above, a God of love. And I was sitting, oh no, here we go again. You know, why don't you do something about it or whatever? And instead, what must he think of the mess that we've made of the world that he created? And that really resonated with me. And I thought, do you know, that's...
But the world that he created is us. I mean, it's not just, you know, the earth and then here we are. You know, I mean, if that's the position that God created the world, well, he created us. And so he even knew the type of, you know, the type of people we would turn out to be, or he didn't. Well, if he didn't, then what sort of creator is he? And if he did, well, then here we all are, you
yeah.
know, and this is what he knew would happen. And, you know, I mean, it's either one or the other, I think. I mean, I don't like that, you know, the false dichotomy thing, but I think that's a genuine one.
No, it is a genuine one.
We can't separate ourselves out from the world that yeah. Freddie Mercury was singing about. And if yeah. he made the earth, he made us. And we're him with all his destructive tendencies, I think.
Well, I don't agree with that. I agree that he did make us, and I agree that he knew what would happen. And therefore, that causes me to think, okay, but he still thought it worth doing. So why are we made the way we are? And I remember someone yeah. saying to me, David, I would believe... I mean, I deal with this every week. I deal with people who are dealing with bereavement or have been told they've got cancer or whatever. And, you know, it's overwhelming with that sense of suffering and everything oh. that goes on. But I would say to somebody, look... I can guarantee you, if I could give you a life in which you had no suffering, no pain, no broken relationships, no cancer, would you accept that? Do you think that's what God should do? And they would say, yes. And I would say, okay, I'll make you a chair. And, you know, a chair does not have any suffering. I mean, you could be Clint Eastwood talking to a chair. You know, you could, the chair cannot respond, the chair cannot feel, the chair...
Yes.
The price that we pay... for being able to laugh, for having a sense of humor. As far as I know, animals don't have a sense of humor. The price that we pay for being able to laugh, the price that we pay for beauty, the price that we pay for love, the price that we pay for companionship and so on, is also means that we have to endure suffering, loneliness,
yes.
sorrow. Life yeah. isn't just one big laugh. You know, I mean, isn't it the case?
Yeah. No, I'm all right with that.
Yeah.
I'm all right with that. I get that trade-off, and I absolutely see that. You know, I mean, the most interesting comedy, the stuff that makes me laugh the most is also the stuff that that is closest to the things that do hurt us, you know, that are that you know, suffering and the rest of it. But as I sort of talked about a little while ago, areas of the world where the suffering is wholesale, you know, geographically, or groups within the world where oppression has managed to you know, be handed down generation after generation, that for me is, you know, when you look at it on a macro scale, is much more difficult to get your head around. I mean, you can talk to you know, a homosexual man who's, you know, or woman who's conflicted and or perhaps not conflicted but has conflict in their family, and counsel them that, you know, that God still loves them, and be very liberal and progressive about the whole thing. But, you know, a huge amount of the way in which we as a society feel about homosexuality and that is defined by the three Abrahamic texts.
But let me, okay, that's almost two separate issues.
What are we to do with that?
Well, okay, I mean,
does God hate gays?
No, let me answer that. I mean, well, let me go back to the areas of the world first, then come on to that one.
Mm.
The areas of the world, I find it fascinating that the areas of the world in which there's most suffering is also the areas in which there's most belief in God. Now, I think people like Richard Dawkins are actually middle-class, elitist, Western liberal Oxford snobs who tend to look down on all these poor Africans when they get educated. You know, they'll come to see there is. In actual fact, I mean, I've done that myself. I've gone to help what used to be called the Scottish Spastics Council. And, I mean, horrendous name now. But I remember going with this very paternalistic, patronizing attitude and being taught more about life and myself by a 21-year-old who was shriveled into a ball that was 3 feet and who couldn't communicate except through what they called a bliss board, and coming away utterly humbled by it. I have people in my church who go to Africa and so on, and they're not the patronizing type. They go and they come back utterly humbled and saying, these people have taught us so much about life and about faith and so on. So I think when you broaden it out, you see it like that. The homosexual issue for me is fascinating because I'm not giving away any trade secrets to say I've always had homosexuals in my congregation. I still teach the Bible's teaching on human sexuality and so on. But for me, the issue is not about homosexuality as a form of identity of who you are. I want to see our identity as being humans, and how we express our sexuality, that comes further down the line, if you like, and how we discuss things and what are involved. I think there's an obsession, actually in the culture rather than the church, but with some in the church I accept, on homosexuality, when for me that's not the issue. The much broader issue is who we are as human beings.
We're going to have to take a quick break, and we'll come back with your response, Marcus, and start to wrap our conversation up. Fascinating as it is, we always run up against the clock in this programme. So we'll take a quick break. Today on Unbelievable, joining me, Justin Brierley, is Marcus Brigstocke on the phone, popular comedian on TV and radio. Why not grab yourself a copy of his book, God Collar? It was released last year. It takes a look at the whole issue of religion, God, and talks... as an atheist, how, even so, Marcus has still had this yearning, a desire to believe in God if he could. David Robertson, minister of St. Peter's Free Church in Dundee, is in the studio with me, and we're discussing together some of these issues. So we'll be back with the final part of today's programme in just a moment's time.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So in our final part of our programme today, comedy and Christianity, we started out talking about stand-up comedy and the kind of cultural impact it has these days. It's almost the modern equivalent of the preacher, says David Robertson, one of my studio guests today. Marcus Brigstocke is a popular comedian on TV and radio. His book God Collar talks about his struggles, though, with religion, and particularly in light of a certain yearning, a longing for God. You talk in the book quite honestly, as you said at the outset, Marcus, the loss of this friend James that started to take you on this journey of questioning this desire to want him to still somehow be there. And that kind of is a kind of the existential issue that faces so many people. Now, some people seem to be able to resolve it quite easily as atheists, but you haven't found those answers quite so satisfactory. I mean, you've got intellectual problems with the concept of God. We've talked about that. It strikes me, though, that you have a very emotional kind of interest, though, in God being there.
Yes.
That there's something emotionally invested in the idea of God for you.
I'm pretty emotional about a great many of the things that I end up writing about, because that's how I go about doing it, and those are the things that that occupy my mind the most. I mean, a new show that I'm doing at the moment is political, but it's very much actually a fairly childish emotional response. But that's fine. I quite like embracing that. It is emotional. All of these things tap into the things that, for me, the questions raised, tap into how I feel about things. Mm-hmm. How does it make me feel when I read, stories from the Bible, the Torah, or the Quran? And how it makes me feel is at turns inspired, angry, upset, lonely, confused, all of these things. And they're all very emotional. So I'm fine with that, and I accept that that's
a key difference. I've met people,
me and Dawkins and Hitchens and stuff.
I
don't think Hitchens was very emotional about the whole thing.
I mean, I've met atheists, or people who were atheists became Christians, for whom what atheism offered, in the sense that it doesn't offer anything, it is a kind of a blank sheet, but at least a naturalistic worldview of, well, this is all there is, and when the lights go out, that's it. That, for them, the way it made them feel was partly what made them open up more to the idea of God. I mean, David, I'd be interested in your sense of is this a good reason to believe in God? That the fact that we feel like this is a great pity, if that's all there is, that we feel the loss so keenly, is there something in that? I've heard some people talk about, well, what you're feeling there, don't just say, is, well, that's just my emotions. There's actually something tangible that relates to, that is transcendent in some way.
Well, I think that any human being, to be human, has to be a mixture of reason and emotion. Every decision we make is a mixture of reason and emotion. I mean, I came here to the studio today because I quite like you, Justin. And, and when I read Marcus's book, there were things that were reasonable in it that I agreed with, things I didn't agree with. But from an emotional side, I reacted quite warmly to it. Other times I thought, oh, no, you've got that wrong. You blasphemous comedian. I'm going to stone you.
That's why I phoned in.
Yeah. Yeah. I was ready to announce my own personal jihad. You're going to be the Salman Rushdie of comedians. But, there's part. I mean, we're like that. We are emotional people. I mean, the way I describe it is this. Marcus, you won't know this, but last year I almost died. I was in hospital for 11 weeks and was in an ICU for 7 weeks, and I wasn't really supposed to live. And I was asked how the experience had changed my theology. In my head before, I'd known that I wasn't going to, that I was mortal, that I would die. And I mean, I obviously believe in eternity and living afterwards. But that didn't change. But what changed was, whereas I knew it in my head before, now I know it in my heart, if you like, in my emotions. Every day I walked out today, in Brixton, where I was staying. I walked out of Brixton and said, Lord, thank you for fresh air, and things like that. So you feel it. So I do think that what you're talking about is, I think you need the intellectual, but you also need what I would call the spiritual. You need God to work in your heart and all that kind of stuff. You said something, forgive me saying this, but there were two quotes that I've just underlined triply. One was, I wish there was a God. I wish for that God to exist now and for all time. I wish to be fully conscious of God, and more importantly, for him to be fully conscious of me. I wish for God to be powerful, infinitely wise, kind, loving, fair, and when necessary, willing to carry out humiliating and painful corrections on my fellow human beings. I'm going to add that to my Bible at the end, because I think that's great. But the one that really struck, and where I was metaphorically, let's put it this way, I hugged you, I want a personal God who loves us all in a way that goes beyond words. A God who fills us with a short sort of reassuring and magical light. A God who's the very expression of love, so perfect that to feel all of it at once would be to lose yourself forever in a place of sublime happiness. I'd love to be able to say my whole life has been like that. It hasn't. But there have been moments of that ecstasy that have occurred in my life that, whatever else, has made me never want to take ecstasy, because it would never compare with that experience. And I'm saying it is there. Now, you can't believe because of my experience.
I see that.
Yeah.
You know, I see that and I admire it. I'm envious of it. I admire it to some extent. It's inspiring. And I see it and I've heard it. And I guess, you know, the ability that I had to express that idea, having not experienced it myself, is based on an understanding that that is how a great many people with faith in their lives do feel about it. And that's terrific. And that is the part that I think, well, I wish I could get there. I just have this clumsy, flawed, jumbled up emotional brain that gets in my way. That's not to suggest for a second that people who have got there, that their brain is in any way inferior or superior to my own, just different.
I agree completely. And, you know, the interesting thing about that is I like the promises that are in the Bible, and I'm not, you know, just cherry picking. I love the one, those who seek me will find me. And I mean, I remember being at the stage that you're at and praying once to a God I wasn't even sure existed. God, if you exist, you show me and I'll serve you the rest of my life. I remember stepping out of a town hall, looking up at the sky, expecting to be smitten by lightning, and nothing happened. But over a period of months, I would say, both through mind, experience, and I would say spiritually, I found that way. And I know this is such a cliche, and there are religious people who give it a bad name, and I apologize for using it. But for me, it did come through Jesus Christ, you know, about him being the way, the truth, and the life. You know, you kind of said, I don't want that to the Father. No, you don't want that to the Father that you've perceived of from, in my view, a misunderstanding and misreading of the Old Testament. But I think you do want it to what I would call this human completeness. I mean, I use the phrases joy, beauty, you know, wholesomeness in the sense of the whole world. I mean, I loved in the book your thing on environmentalism, because to me that's a Christian perspective. And there are so many things that I just looked at that and thought, you're asking all the right questions. You know, I just hope you find the answer.
Well, yeah, likewise. And there's a story that I talked about in the book about the Four Horsemen, which is the video that they did on YouTube, Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, Hitchens, and Dawkins, where they sit and talk. They sort of put faith over an atheist assault course with no one there from faith to represent, and then they watch it flounder and trip. But they all sit and they wonder about how on earth anybody could still believe these ideas given what we now know, and how on earth anybody could sort of seek to escape into religion. And they all drink alcohol throughout the process. And I just thought it was very interesting, without being puritanical and judgmental about it, which I'm not, for them to sit there, and those four very intelligent minds, and I think that they all are, were in Hitch's case, to miss that important detail that humans will seek constantly to alter our reality, because we think a lot and we feel a lot, and we will constantly seek answers. And some people will look for answers in a single glass of wine, and perhaps they'll find them. You know, it takes the sharp edges off the world. And others will turn, you know, to bottle after bottle after bottle, and that'll be a disaster, in the same way that people will find answers and comfort and inspiration and love and all the rest of it in religion, and others will find it a useful way of propping up hateful ideas that they have in their minds. But that desire within all of us to escape into relationships, alcohol, the cinema, a long walk, whatever it may be, an experience in church, that's in us as people, and I get that.
But the question is then, you know, why is it in us? Because I read all of these guys. I mean, I must admit, I loved Hitchens. Dawkins, I wrote a book about. I'll send you a copy of it, actually, the Dawkins letters. They didn't like it because it was humorous. But they thought I was being too harsh and so on, making fun of them. But where I would agree with you is at one level that, you know, we all seek something. Where I would disagree is your implication being, well, you know, religion is one escape avenue, which I think it is for many people. But I would argue that the reason we're thirsting and hungering after something is because there is something to hunger and thirst after. C.S. Lewis put it beautifully when he said the reason we have sexual desires is because there's sex. The reason we have hunger is because there's food. And the reason we have a longing for God is because there's a God. And I would say that's exactly where I'm coming from. I don't want religion to be used as an escape from reality, nor as an escape from science, nor as an escape from our circumstances and relationships. I want it to be... The way I describe it is my experience with malt whiskey. I love malt whiskey. And I genuinely... There's a story told... In fact, it's not a story. I was there. A minister friend of mine was doing a funeral in an old Highland village, and the whiskey, a dram was handed round at the end of the funeral to everybody, those who didn't had orange juice. All the ministers, of course, had whiskey. And the old elder said, "You'll give thanks for the whiskey." And the minister said, "Oh, no, 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 no." And the old elder said, "Well, if you can't give thanks for it, you're not getting it." And he took it out of his hand. And he made us publicly give thanks for the whiskey. Well, yeah. I there's a psalm that talks about wine that makes glad the heart of a man. I find my faith in Christ doesn't inoculate me from the sufferings in the world, neither does it deaden the pleasures. In fact, it accentuates them all. I feel the suffering more, but I also feel the pleasures more. So I genuinely sit down at night with my Laphroaig or my Talisker or whatever, have one dram of it. I don't get plastered because I don't need to, and what an expensive waste of alcohol, you know. Mm. I genuinely enjoy and do that, and I do that as part of my Christian living. And I think that's possible.
Yes. And I like what you said about C.S. Lewis, but you see, immediately I thought, well, you know, that idea, we want sex because there's sex, we want food because we're hungry, and we want God because there's God. Well, I've had food and I've had sex, sometimes at the same time, but I haven't seen God.
You don't need to see him. But you don't need to see
it. And so the questions that I have, which are not quite the same as hunger for food or desire for sex, are not... I don't see that parallel as clearly. I get it, but I don't see that parallel as clearly as hunger for food or desire for sex or, you know, the questions that I have being evidence that there is God. I get it, and it's neat, but that's not the same for me.
Yeah,
we are going to have to draw things to a close. It's fascinating to talk to you, Marcus, and I've really enjoyed.
It's very unfair to give me the last word.
Well, somebody's got to have the last word. And
well, okay, I'll take it. all I'll say is, yes, you haven't experienced yet, but there's a lovely verse in the Psalms that says, "Taste and you shall see that God is good," and that'll be my last word.
All right.
Yeah, fair enough.
Thank you so much, Marcus, anyway, for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Really interesting. Thanks so much for being so generous with your time as well. So, Marcus, if you want to find out more about him, of course, I'll put details of his website, his book, etc., with the podcast of this programme. You can find that at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Thanks also to David for joining me this week and last as well on the programme. Well, I hope you very much enjoyed that discussion. And if you find yourself casually hopping from place to place after listening to this podcast, you'll know why. Thank you very much for being with us on today's Classic Replay. You can find much more. Our newsletter, for instance, there's a link to that from today's show. And if you sign up, you'll get all kind of added bonus as well. You'll get things like a link to ask NT Wright a question. You'll get bonus content from the show. You'll get the regular newsletter, a weekly newsletter with all of our fantastic content. And of course, you will get access to all of our website as well, premierunbelievable.com. Oh, and a free ebook. Forgot to mention that. So lots of reasons to register for the newsletter. Do it if you can. It'll be a great way to keep in touch with the show. For now, thanks for being with us and see you next time.